new pencil case, new uniform, and a smile on her face. You gave birth to your baby, she's the fruit of your womb. Now you're gonna hand her over to the walls of the room. First they'll take it and they'll break it, and they'll make her full of hives. Steal the seeds that you sowed, do a number on her mind. Fill her up with propaganda, so she'll wanna be a serf. For the dreams of Alice Bailey and the Luciferians. You should better watch out what you're teaching your children. Watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome-based education from the world curriculum. You better watch out.
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased to welcome back to the programme Dr. Duke Pester, who is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, with a PhD in Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature and the academic director of Freedom Project Education. In addition to a wide experience in university teaching, both undergraduate and postgraduate, Dr. Pester is also very active in educational reform, especially with respect to Common Core in the US education system, which he kindly joined us last year, over a year ago now, to discuss, and which we'll be talking about again today by way of an update on what's been going on in the intervening period. Dr. Pester, thanks very much for coming back on the program. Good to be speaking with you again.
Yes, always great to be talking to you, Julian.
Thank you. Well, I am very pleased that you've come on, because last time you gave us a very detailed introduction to Common Core, explaining the history and the philosophy of this so-called educational program. But at the time, we concentrated on the maths and English standards, because that was pretty much kind of the state of play back then. But you did say that you would be willing to return to the show to give us an update on further developments as they gradually rolled out. And so that's going to be the focus of our conversation today, bringing in into the discussion other subject areas, however they may be brought in. We'll find out as we go along, such as history and science and maybe other things as well. But as is regularly the case with these interviews where we revisit subjects, I really can't assume that everybody will have heard that particular interview. Although I'm bound to say, please, listeners, do go back and listen to that first interview with Dr. Pester, because there's a lot of information in there. But as I say, I'm not going to assume that people have heard it, so perhaps it would be a good idea to start with something of a recap on all of this. So could you give us a kind of condensed introduction to Common Core? What is it? Where did it come from?
Sure, yeah. It's a complicated question, obviously. It requires hours and hours of conversation, but yeah. But I kind of boiled down a version for these kind of situations, and it works like this. There are two main fundamental problems with Common Core. It is effectively a set of national standards for English and math. That's the way it was conceived, which is illegal under the American system of government. The 10th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits federal meddling to this degree in state educational policy. And second of all, three different federal statutes dating from 1965 prohibit the establishment of national standards or a national curriculum. Our founding fathers understood and made no provision for public education because they recognized that when you put the federal government in charge of what our kids learned and how they learned it, then it wouldn't be too long before the feds were educating for their purposes, not necessarily in the best interest of the citizenship. And we have found that to be true. So there are two primary problems with Common Core. Number one, it takes way too much state and local control, family control, away from parents in terms of educational decisions. Much less ability for a parent who's upset about a lesson or a book or a methodology to go to the school and change anything. Our system for a long time gave the parents and teachers a lot of authority in being able to correct what was wrong in public education when things went off the rails. Now that this has been ceded largely to the federal government, the ability to get any kind of meaningful intervention for moms and dads, who are the, let's face it, who are the primary stakeholders of public education, that's gone now. It's all about big, broad, federalized curriculum and federalized standards-based education, testing, And there's very little impact that local state schools can have or moms and dads can have. And the second problem then with Common Core, besides this, in our system, illegal takeover of too much of what education is the fact that whenever a big federal bureaucracy, it's certainly been our case in America for 50 years now, whenever a big federal bureaucracy cedes to itself power it doesn't legally have, they use that power to import all sorts of politics and ideology into the system, in this case, education. They use it to circumvent education for very narrow political and, I would argue, ultimately statist ends. And we are seeing, we're reaping the fruits of that now in the 6 years that Common Core has been part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that it's an illegal takeover. So, I mean, the question that immediately comes to mind is, well, how on earth did they manage to do it then if it's illegal?
Well, very sly, very sly. What they did is they basically contracted out the creation of Common Core to two private Washington lobbyist groups, two big money groups whose job it was to lobby politicians, to bring politicians and donors and constituent groups into contact with politicians. These two groups were the NGA, the National Governors Association, and the CCSSO, the Council of Chief State School Officers. Now, those are both august-sounding names, but the National Governors Association wasn't 50 state governors coming together to write education policy. It was advocates and lobbyists who saw an opportunity. And so these two groups became the umbrella organizations in which the Common Core standards were created. The whole scheme was funded primarily by Bill Gates and his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Private, progressive technocrat funded the writing of the standards. Now, all that was done, and it wasn't federal. But as we know, certainly in America, the only way you could get anything like this into our American public schools, and I'm going to, for the sake of your audience, Julian, I'm going to stop calling them public schools now, because public schools implies that they're ours, they belong to the people. I'm going to call them what they are, they're government schools now. And so what happened was, is that the only way you could get this into our government schools is with federal intervention. And the federal government back in 2009, the very year that President Obama took office, they created the Federal Race to the Top program, which was basically a huge giveaway of taxpayer dollars by way of grants to state education departments. Every state in America was urged, actually in some ways arm-twisted, to apply for this huge federal giveaway. New York, for instance, in 2009 was the first state in the union to receive a Race to the Top grant. $700 million went from the Fed directly to the New York State Board of Education. Ultimately, over 40 states ended up taking Race to the Top money. And the condition was any state that took Race to the Top money had to accept the Common Core standards when they were finally written. In other words, most of the states who took Common Core took it sight unseen and took it simply as a consequence of taking this quote unquote free government money directly turned over to education departments. In other words, it was a great big bribe to get states to take it. And that's how they avoided the illegality of what they were doing.
And what would you say would be the philosophy that will be shared by these lobby groups that were so powerful in this?
Well, I think the lobbyists were interested in the money that can be generated. I don't necessarily think the lobbying groups were engaging in this for nakedly politically partisan reasons. Let's face it, there's a lot of government contracts that went out, a lot of government money that was dispersed to entities attached to these lobbying groups for the privilege of being the cover groups for Common Core. So there was a lot of money to be made. A lot of crony capitalism taking place here. I think ultimately the single best one-sentence definition of what Common Core is as follows, quote, "It is an unholy alliance between an out-of-control federal government and a very small group of crony capitalist organizations who work with that federal government to create, maintain, make money, and ultimately profit from the standards. What happens is these crony capitalist companies get the money, and the government gets the control." And we've seen that pattern through almost every nascent statist country in the last 100 years. It's always worked that way until, of course, the government becomes so preeminent that the very crony capitalist companies get driven out of business, too.
Right. It's interesting that you earlier brought up the term technocratic. And this will come up later in our conversation, I'm quite sure. But the further you think about this, where you have this hand-in-hand cooperation between corporations and government on this high level, that the analysis seems to point in the direction of pure control for ideological reasons at the end of the day. But no doubt we will come to that a little later on. Now, one of the things which really bugs me about this, and this came into our previous conversation, was the small input that there ever was from subject specialists in developing the Common Core standards. And you mentioned a couple of people that stick in my mind, Milgram and Stotsky. I'm afraid I've forgotten their first names. One was a maths expert, one's an English expert, and they've been very deeply critical of the way all of this was handled. Could you just remind us about all that?
Sure, yeah, and that's a great point. There was very little parent involvement in this. So the primary stakeholders of the so-called public education system weren't consulted, number one. That was in all the schools before any mom and dad had any idea what it was. And number two, education specialists, teachers were really frozen out of this. This is one of those rare examples, Julian, of an issue that so outrages the left and the right. This is not merely a conservative issue, a Republican issue. We have radical teachers unions in the country, radical progressive teachers unions who despise this, who are fighting this on the ground alongside with Tea Party activists, precisely because the teachers were frozen out. Teachers are being measured now. They're being judged primarily on their ability to get kids to these ridiculously big exams. And the problem is that teachers didn't write the exams. Teachers don't even get to see the exams, and they certainly don't get to grade them. So you're holding teachers hostage now to a set of exams that there is no meaningful teacher input. And that's a problem. And you mentioned James Milgram and Professor Stan Drastotsky. These are two university professors who were hired by the Common Core to evaluate their own math and English standards. Milgram is one of the preeminent mathematicians in the world today. He's retired. But much of the math that got America to the moon in the late 1960s, Milgram did as a very young man. So he's a major mathematician. He's the only serious mathematician that was invited onto the committee to evaluate the math standards. And he said, get rid of them. Throw them out immediately. This is going to set our kids way behind. Stotsky is the English professor, also the only English expert with any national standards curriculum ability who was invited. She said the same thing about the English standards. Both of them, after reviewing the curriculum, said jettison it. And so what did the Common Core people do? They simply ignored what Stotsky and Milgram said and went ahead and validated their standards anyway.
And the idea behind things being a lower standard, from what you said last time, was this philosophy of the leveling of the playing field for everybody, I understand, that this kind of fairness and social justice distorted into this sense of everybody has to be exactly the same.
And if there's one thing that is crystallized beyond opposition over the last year since we talked, it's that. We now see across every aspect of Common Core, from the textbook publishers to the testing itself, to the way the standards are playing out in the schools, to the pedagogy that's grown up to help teachers learn how to teach Common Core, the one thing it emphasizes more than anything else is social justice. It's not about allowing kids to achieve. It's not about letting kids gain mastery over certain subject areas. It's not about preparing them for college. It's not about helping them be more internationally competitive. Every aspect of this, from top to bottom, reinforces a politically correct, progressive social justice mindset. In fact, the very name Common Core, as we suggested last time, has proved to be the point. Our kids are common. They're not unique. Our kids aren't special. Our kids aren't radically different with different skills and abilities. It's not fair, Julian, that your son can do really good at math and my son is really good at English but not good at math. So what we need is to commonize everything so that nobody jumps ahead, nobody falls too far behind. And if you're going to get 60 million American school kids to exactly the same place in every subject, by definition, it has to be a much lower place.
And so this is being socially engineered. And I'm thinking of this guy called David Coleman, who you spoke about previously. And he came up again in this presentation that you gave more recently. And amazingly, from the little video clips you had there, he was admitting that he has basically no educationalist credentials. And I'm just wondering, where is this guy coming from? He seems to be a big cheese in all of this. Is he essentially an ideologue, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. David Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. David Coleman is the architect of Common Core. He calls himself that. His own Wikipedia page calls himself that. And everybody involved with the standards recognizes that he is the primary mover. This is a guy with absolutely no educational background. He has no degree in education. He's never studied education. He's never taught in a classroom. He's a technocrat. In fact, he came to the attention of the Obama administration precisely because he helped manipulate data for the 2008 campaign. He recognized, David Coleman, the power of data, technocracy, to drive people to the polls and manipulate how they vote. And he's many times in those video clips that you had seen, he boasts about the ability of technology to transform the world. And so he's the architect of Common Core. No credentials. But this is the really shocking thing.
No sooner did he help to write the English and math standards than David Coleman immediately stepped down from the Common Core Committee. And right now, he is the president of the College Boards. And the College Boards is the institution that creates our ACT and SAT exams. All of our college entrance exams are run by ultimately the College Boards. He's the president of that now, where the same unqualified educational official who created the Common Core Standards is now transforming America's college entrance exams to conform to his Common Core Standards. This is what we call a banana republic stuff. This is a guy, unqualified, who's never been elected to anything. Moms and dads, voters and taxpayers have no authority over him. There's no way we can get to him. He's given this kind of power off the grid, a single man, to transform how American education is delivered and processed.
It is incredible. And just listening to those video clips that you have, there's some of them he seems to be almost celebrating them. I'm exaggerating, but he seems quite proud of the fact that he has no background in this, almost as if, you know, he's one of the people and therefore, you know, that very fact of his commonality with other people gives him some sort of credence to be doing what he's doing, which is exactly the opposite of what I would have thought. You would want somebody who actually knows something about education as a discipline.
So with that in mind, I'm about to jump in, but I'm just going to say one word about my own organization, which is Student Achievement Partners. Student Achievement Partners, all you need to know about us are a couple of things. One is we're composed of that collection of unqualified people who were involved in developing the Common Standards.
Well, is this not a hallmark of statist thinking? I remember studying the Maoist revolution in China, and one of the first things Mao did when he took power was to take doctors out of hospitals and put them on farms shoveling manure, and he took farmers and stuck them in the hospitals, put lab coats on them, and said, you're a doctor now, so get with it. There's this sort of proletarian idea that as long as our progressive bona fides are good, everybody's an expert on everything. That one clip that stands out to me that you mentioned in the video presentation is the one where he basically says, there is no force on earth strong enough to prevent your teachers from teaching to my tests.
Teachers will teach towards the test. There is no force strong enough on this earth to prevent that. There's no amount of hand waving. There's no amount of saying they teach to the standards, not the test. We don't do that here, whatever.
I mean, that's a remarkable statement from a guy with no basic training or education, that I've created tests for all 60 million American school kids. I've created tests, and every single school teacher in America is going to have to jettison what they know and teach exclusively to the tests I've helped create. That's the kind of quasi-despotic nonsense that we associate with banana republics. And what's so maddening, as you say about it, Julian, is that the voters, the taxpayers, the moms and dads, if all of America rose up tomorrow and decided they despise these standards, there's no way to get at this fella. There's no legal or executive or electoral way that we have to do anything about this at all.
Mm. Yeah, that business of teaching to the test, I find that remarkable, really, because that seems to go the opposite of the traditional view of assessing students. I mean, just thinking of subjects, areas like, you know, the humanities and the arts, because that's what I'm familiar with. You know, you were taught a subject, you were encouraged to read around quite widely in some cases, then you're given fairly open-ended, wide-ranging essay titles for your exam, you know, that sort of thing, you know, in the hope there it would catch some of the learning that had taken place. And if you'd been reasonably diligent in your learning, there would always be something that you could answer. And that wasn't a perfect system by any means, but it meant that you were developing a breadth of knowledge and a responsibility for your learning and perhaps even enjoying your learning. But teaching to the test seems to cut across so much of that.
That's exactly right. There's this canard, this red herring out there that anybody opposes Common Core just doesn't want standards. It's absurd. As we know, as long as you've got a teacher or a professor assigning grades and giving tests and assessing student behavior, you have a standard. And I would argue that this is one of the things I happen to admire greatly about the Oxford system, about how college works in places like the UK. You oftentimes have professors who are dealing individually with students, literally having these interviews, right, where the professor grills the student, becomes a mentor, and the student responds to specific questions from the professor. I mean, that's the best way to do it, right? Because what you're doing is you're giving a standard, putting it in the hands of the teacher and the student. The two of them have been working together for a semester. They know exactly what the professor wants and exactly what the student has to master. And then you have a perfectly closed system whereby real assessment can take place. What we're doing in America now is as far removed from that system as is conceivably possible. Now, it's not teachers who are responsible for assessing what's going on in their own classrooms. It's not local school districts. It's not states. This is federal bureaucracy now, determining what and how kids will learn at what time and when. And what you see what happens with this is there's no room for individualism. There's no room. Every teacher has different gifts. Every student has different capacities. There's no ability to take into account any of that now. It's all just scripted. And this is why left-wing teachers groups in this country are as opposed to this as people on the right. People on the right oppose it from the fact that this is too much government control. It's too much indoctrination. People on the left in America oppose it because you're destroying teachers. Teachers who are the ones who are trained, they no longer have the ability to affect anything other than what goes on in these tests.
Well, I have to say that we're experiencing something, a kind of an echo of this going on at the moment over here, because my daughter has just gone to high school, secondary school as we call it here, and in English she has a system that's called, presumably you know about it, Accelerated Reader. The school seems to have bought into this from a company called Renaissance Learning Company. And this, what this system does is it identifies your child's reading level. It does give them a vast selection of books to choose from, so that's good, I suppose. But and then it gives each book a weighting in points, and it assigns a target of points for your child to reach by the end of each term. And then your child takes little tests at the end of each book to get points. Now, you know, I can see that kind of makes your child accountable for what they're reading, because they're tested and they're given points. But it shifts the motivation for the child away from reading, just for the love of it, towards getting loads and loads of points. And it therefore takes away something of the relationship between the student and the teacher, because the teacher is looking at how many points have you got, and the child is wondering, oh, I haven't got enough points. And you know what I mean? It's sort of, it's in the way of what I would consider to be a more relationship-based way of teaching.
Yeah, we have something very similar here with Common Core. And you see what it does. It reduces learning to an exercise in test taking, that the purpose of learning is not self-enrichment, is not wide-scale cultural literacy. It's not even the pleasure that comes with being a well-read person. It's now a metrics game, isn't it? It's a race to justify. Ultimately, I think it's the college and career-ready mindset. It's very utilitarian,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. She doesn't like it, you know. She's already said that she's really beginning to be put off reading, which is horrendous, really. That's exactly the opposite of what you think it was trying to achieve, what they say it's trying to achieve.
Yeah, and isn't that always the way? I mean, I keep using the word statist here because I want to be as broad as possible. Statist in the sense that idea that somehow centralized, federalized governments, bureaucracies understand better what's good for us than parents do, or than local communities do, or local religious groups do. This is a very statist mindset, isn't it? It encompasses everything from Marxism to simple radical progressivism. And it's that idea, right, that even non-educational specialists like David Coleman know what's better for you and your family than you do. And if that's going to be true, that bureaucrats have to control everything, then you have to keep setting up, don't you? All of these absurd metric ways of trying to guarantee that kids are getting what we want them to get. And of course, what do? Lose along the way. You lose the joy of learning. You lose individualism. You learn genuine multiculturalism and multi-ethnic perspectives. Those go away because of this one-size-fits-all perspective. Every kid is reduced to a number and a statistic.
Yes, indeed. This hit us straight away at the first meeting we had. It wasn't a parents' meeting where you would meet your teachers. It was a whole hall of parents were being presented to. And this was our first experience, really, as soon as she'd started there, a couple of weeks after she started there. And we were told straight away that as soon as the students come in, they are being assessed for their likely grades at 16. And we found that quite horrific. We were looking around you to see if anybody else was outraged by this. We've since had, this is only a few weeks later, we've had her predicted grades for when she's 16. So there's a metric going on there. And then how can they use that data in order to, you know, move her towards these results or even beyond these results? And I'm just thinking, can't we have some space in this learning so that she can enjoy it? And then we can worry about the exams, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line. But as soon as she goes through the door, that's what's in view. It's incredible.
Well, and you know, too, the logistics of this. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? That the bean counters and the metricians and the technocrats responsible for assessing this numerology, these numbers, their jobs and careers depend on their predictions being right. So what inevitably happens is that just like teaching to the test doesn't teach knowledge, it teaches a cynical way of pursuing a test, so too this kind of metric-based, you know, we're going to find out at age 8 what she's going to know at age 16, that then narrows all possible doors. It doesn't allow kids to change or develop or grow. And what it does is it forces them ever more narrowly into a straitjacket educationally that then justifies the premises of the test givers. And that's the big problem.
I'd be interested to know what you think Bill Gates' angle is on this. He's put quite a lot of money into this. What do you think his game is? I mean, is he just being altruistic, or do you think he has something else in mind?
Well, that's what gets me. Bill Gates is a private citizen. He has no he's another one who's never been elected to anything. And I love my friends on the American left who hate billionaires and hate corporatists and hate how the 1% is constantly intervening itself in the governing of the country. And yet then, when somebody like Bill Gates donates billions of dollars to Common Core, nary a word is spoken. There's no pro. If this had been anybody else but Bill Gates, it would be front page news on everybody's newspapers. Rogue billionaire buys public education. But because Bill Gates is a respected man of the left, a very good progressive, we're mum about this. But you asked a great question. What is Bill Gates' angle here? I should point out that first and foremost, Bill Gates has spent a lot of money on Common Core, but he will stand to make a lot of money on it. It's been estimated that over 70% of American school districts, 70, are going to have to radically upgrade their technology and their hard and software capacity to be able to engage in the kind of testing that the Common Core requires. Well, whose computers, whose software, hardware do you think is going into most of those schools? It's Microsoft, right? So in other words, he's paying money out tax-free because it's a charitable donation. He's paying money out to Common Core and raking in all this money by these schools who are buying all of his products and getting another tax breaks because those schools, for educational purposes, don't have to pay the taxes. Having said all that, that's not even what I think the purpose of Bill Gates getting involved in. The real purpose for Gates is he's a technocrat, like we said. And what does that mean? Bill Gates profoundly believes in the power of technology, his technology, to completely alter and transform civil society. The ability of technology to group, to gather, to sort, to categorize people, all in the name of controlling and changing them. That's why Gates is involved with this.
So this is a kind of social dimension of transhumanism, really, from a philosophical point of view.
Very well said. And you think about it, it's not just Gates. This is why Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg got into such trouble a few years ago, because they were basically gathering data and turning it over to the federal government on people using Facebook without consulting the people. People don't realize that back in 2009, as soon as the president took office, Zuckerberg actually had a little office at the White House where he could work on this data stuff in conjunction with the president's staff. So it's not just Gates, but you have a whole technocracy now who is using things like the Patriot Act, for instance, as an excuse to begin to spy on people, gather huge amounts of metadata, and begin to process that data to be able to manipulate various population groups in the country for various purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I would have, you know, on the face of it, I would have said, well, perhaps you're being a little bit cynical about Bill Gates and what you said there. But I have to take into account one thing that he was reported to have said in the Washington Post. This was from September 2013, where this is his exact quote. It would be great if our education stuff worked, but that we won't know for probably a decade.
It would be great if our education stuff worked, but that we won't know for probably a decade.
And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if you really had faith in this from an educational point of view, there's no way that you would say that. So I'm thinking there's got to be something that was motivating you that isn't actually educational. Otherwise, you wouldn't be putting it in that way.
Well, think about it. Our kids are guinea pigs. We were sold on Common Core. Americans were told that this is going to make your kids better. It's been tested. It's been internationally benchmarked. And of course, we now know categorically never was never done. There's not a shred. It's one of the reasons James Milgram, the great math professor, said no way, because this was never tested. They told him, when they invited him in to evaluate the math program, they told him it had been internationally tested. He said, okay, you hired me. Show me the math you did to test this. And they never provided it because they never did it, which is why he balked at it. So our kids are guinea pigs with this. What Bill Gates said there is exactly right. They don't even know if this is going to work. And the other thing you want to look into, Julian, is back in 2004, Bill Gates actually signed a mutual agreement pact. It's on the internet, with the United Nations to begin to affect global education policies. So this is somebody who's got a long history. 4 years before Obama became president, Bill Gates was working with the United Nations to begin to craft an educational policy that ultimately could be exportable to every single nation on Earth. Kind of the educational equivalent of one world government becomes one world education. Everybody learning the same thing the same day, the same time, at the same age.
Yes, that actually neatly links into what I was going to ask you from your presentation, Common Core from Farce to Failure, where you say something like, this is not your exact words, but something like Common Core has got more to do with global citizenship than it has to do with critical thinking, which I thought was an interesting way of putting it, because those two are obviously not necessarily incompatible, that is, global citizenship and critical thinking, although I can see that in many ways there is a tension there. Can you explain what you were getting at with that kind of comment?
I think the word you used before is right, social engineering. The idea is that we are too American, we are too liberty-minded, we are too bound to our Constitution. These are criticisms, by the way, that European elites have been leveling at us in America for years, right? Too mired in liberty, too constitutional-based, too isolationist, not globalist enough. And so the liberal elites in our country who crafted Common Core are doing the same thing. They're basically churning American schools into incubators for a globalist worldview as opposed to an Americanist worldview. They are undercutting Judeo-Christian values, and they are unmaking the founding documents. One interesting thing, Common Core prohibits teaching kids cursive writing, handwriting. Everything is printed or typed on computers or on iPads. One interesting codicil of this, despite the fact that many child development specialists point out that when kids learn how to write in cursive, there are all sorts of brain connections that occur that help them remember what they're doing much more than when they're printing. Regardless of that, all of the founding documents of this country were handwritten. And so now in our middle and elementary schools, kids cannot read the founding documents unless they have been transcribed. And so we have, you look at the textbooks for Common Core, and when they teach kids things like the Second Amendment, that's the American amendment in the Constitution where people have the right to keep and bear arms, very controversial amongst liberals. But when our kids now are reading about the Second Amendment, they're not reading it as it was actually written. The textbooks have paraphrased it and printed it rather than exposing them to the real handwritten thing, and they're changing the meaning. If you read the Second Amendment in one of these Common Core textbooks, it makes it very clear that you're only allowed to have guns in a state militia, which is not what the initial document said. So we're using that as a way then, right, of dismantling constitutional values, dismantling history, rewriting sort of the basic idea of America for our little kids that aligns it not with American history and American documents, but with larger, broader internationalist agendas.
Right. Yeah, and I'm going to ask you in a moment about history standards. I think I've misunderstood quite how those are being applied, but we'll come back to that in a moment. I just wondered whether the way I kind of make sense of this to myself when I think of critical thinking is I go to the definition of understanding, which is often used, which is the ability to tell the difference between opposites. So you say that A is not non-A, and you build a framework of understanding the world by seeing those differences between things. And global citizenship seems to fit more with a kind of oneness view of the world where all differences are dissolved. And if that is correct, then I can see why critical thinking would be bad for global citizenship, because that would enable people to see differences between things. And as soon as you have differences, you have reason for strife and reason for dissent, etc., etc.
I think yours was a more specific statement of what I was trying to say. I think you're right. This one world business, this globalist agenda, the big problem with it, like you say, is it doesn't present alternative worldviews. For instance, now, we'll give you one more example. Our elementary school books now for kids, we're talking first, second, third graders, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, it's all full of, for kids that young, it's all full of man-made global warming. And I personally, I'm not bothered by the teaching of global warming, although I can't imagine why you'd do it for 7 and 6-year-olds. But I'm not bothered by it as long as you are teaching kids that there are challenges, right? That this is what some people, but we're not doing it. And with all of the subject areas we're teaching now, everything is coming from a particularly progressive agenda. There are no, to paraphrase what you just said, to have critical thinking, there has to be dissent. There has to be exposure to other ways of seeing things. Yeah. And what makes Common Core common is that it's common in the sense that every kid gets exposed to the same same tired old worldview perspectives. And there is no genuine debate. There is no genuine engagement with ideas, even ideas that on occasion we might find unwholesome. All that's gone now. It's all coming from one perspective, one angle. And as you said earlier, kids are being tested, not on how well they know material, but on how well they parrot the worldview. Mm-hmm. That's the dangerous thing.
It is absolutely dangerous, yes. Do you know whether this has any connection to Robert Mueller's World Core Curriculum? Robert Mueller, who was Assistant Secretary General of the UN for 40 years, and he had world government views. He was a bit of a New Ager. Do you know if there's any link there?
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I could not give you a specific link to what's going on to that man, but there's no doubt that UNESCO has played a huge role in this since at least after World War II. You know, the initial, one of the early mottos for UNESCO, the United Nations Education Arm, was your kids are our kids. That was UNESCO. Your children are ours. That idea that we're all one body, all kids belong to the same worldview. And that's who Bill Gates linked up with back in 2004. It was exactly the United Nations Education Wing that Bill Gates was linking up with about this drive towards broadening American education so that it was geared towards the world and not to the not to being a citizen in this country, but to be becoming a citizen of the world. And going back before UNESCO, we all know, right, that the two founding fathers of American public education, Horace Mann and John Dewey, they both wanted American public education precisely to make it more global and less uniquely American.
It's very interesting, that phrase, your kids are our kids. That could be taken in two different ways, couldn't it? I mean, it could be, they're our kids in the sense that we care for them, or our kids in the sense that we own them, I'm afraid.
And isn't that pretty much the entire modus operandi, that amphibology, that binary? Yes, what we say is both benign and sinister, depending upon who's in control of it.
Oh. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's rather worrying, isn't it? Indeed. Now, this has been implemented in stages, and you discussed the English and maths last time, so we need to come on to other areas. So, I mean, I said to you before the interview, I'd like you to talk about the history standards, but you immediately had to qualify even my very question. So can you explain what's going on with that?
Yeah, this is a really shocking, and it's a nice transition for us. First of all, Common Core in America is branding so badly, people despise it. Moms and dads hate it, teachers hate it, that the people in charge of it have decided it is not in their best interests to push any new standards. When American states took Common Core back in 2009 and 10, they only agreed to take English and math. No American state ever formally agreed to take anything else. And I think what would happen is, if they came out with a formal Common Core history or Common Core science, the states wouldn't take them. It's just too controversial. So they've done the next best thing. They've renamed the science standard. Start there for a moment. So we now have Common Core Science in our schools, but it's not called Common Core Science. It's called the Next Generation Science Standards. They just simply renamed them. And if you go to the Next Generation Science Standards, you will see all throughout their document, their explanatory documents, the whole thing is Common Core, but they just gave it a different name. And with history, they've done something even more alarming. They've decided that they are not going to come out with history standards. What they're going to do is subordinate the teaching of history to the English language arts program that states already adopted. In other words, teaching of history and social studies now becomes part of, for lack of a better word, the entire English paradigm that was already adopted by Common Core. This way, they can slip in Common Core history into the existing English standards and not have to justify what they've done by going back to the states.
So how does that work? How do you teach history within an English timetable and yet still be teaching enough history for it to be, you can actually say that is a subject that you're learning?
Well, you can't. And that's what they've done. They've melded almost the entire humanities curriculum into this broad rubric called English Language Arts. And you may remember last year, Julian, when we talked, that already English class wasn't about books anymore. Up to 50% or more of all the literature our kids used to read in English class has been replaced by Common Core with texts that are already sociology, history, psychology, or social studies. So in other words, instead of reading the great classics of the Western world, like the Odyssey, the Aeneid, Milton's Paradise Lost, kids were reading global warming texts in English class. They were reading watered down versions of history. So what they've done is they've destroyed the idea that in the humanities you have discrete disciplines, that history requires a different way of understanding than literature, and they've amalgamated them all. And so now you have a situation where the only history that gets taught is history that reinforces what's being taught in English, which is all sociology, not literature and art. And all that gets reinforced in other subject areas. So kids are getting a comprehensive humanistic education that every discrete subject area now is telling them exactly the same thing in exactly the same way. They're only getting as much history as they need to understand the narratives that the architects of Common Core want taught.
Isn't it right, though, that U.S. history should be demythologized to an extent? I mean, one of the things often said is this idea of American exceptionalism is very strong in the States. You know, the sense that America always does what is right, you know, that really is very strong, which does make it very hard for people to, say, critique what government does, especially in the area of foreign policy. So is there not something to be said for, as I say, demythologizing U.S. history to some extent?
Well, I guess one thing I would say is that even under the banner of American exceptionalism, it never stopped us from teaching slavery. It never stopped American schools from really allowing kids to see the warts and all view of American history. I guess, you know, I grew up in the 70s, and I very much got a warts and all view of American history. My teachers were quick to point out, and that's always been the case. In fact, that's true of Western education generally. I know it's true in Europe. There's always been a willingness on the part of Western schools to analyze the good with the bad. It's one of the things that separates Western education from education in a lot of other places. What we've done now, I would argue, is an anti-mythological perspective. As a university professor for over the last 20 years, my kids come to college and all they know are the negative aspects right. of American history. I'll give you one example. Every semester I ask my kids this because it comes up. Well over 90% of my students only think slavery existed because America instituted it. I do not have a single kid in my class this semester who can tell me a meaningful thing about slavery anywhere else in the world, going all the way back to Pharaoh and going all the way ahead to today. They think, our kids, that slavery was a uniquely American institution, that it began with the colonists and it ended with the Civil War, and they have no historical background whatsoever. So we've moved from a system where perhaps there was too much one-sided patriotism in education to one where America is uniquely responsible for the world's problems. And I have to point this out. You're going to get a huge kick out of this. You know what David Coleman, who's in charge of the college boards, one of the responsibilities of the college boards is to create the advanced placement history exams that kids take in high school to get college credit. The very first one of those, he rewrote all the AP exams. He rewrote the AP U.S. history program, David Coleman did. And it is shocking. A number of liberal university professors challenged him because they argued, you're giving kids a one-sided view of American history. You are showing them what's wrong with the American system, but nowhere do you point out what we have in common or what works. To which David Coleman replied, quote, facts aren't all that important in teaching history, unquote. Do you know what he said was important? What he said was important were historical narratives. Rather than teach kids the facts of the founding of the country and what the Constitution says, we now teach them narratives. Like, okay, I'll give you one example. The South Dakota State Legislature a few months ago. I know a lot of Brits aren't quite sure where that is. South Dakota is right in the middle of the country, a big prairie, a very conservative state typically. But the school legislature, because of what David Coleman did to history teaching, they decided that they were not going to teach any American history in high schools before 1890. So in South Dakota high schools, kids will only learn American history starting with 1890, the rise of the Progressive Era. There will be no colonialism taught. There will be no founding documents taught. Why? Because for our kids to get college credit, they have to adapt to this teaching standard. So you start in 1890 when Irish and Italian immigrants were coming here and oftentimes were treated badly. And so the reflection is, why were they treated badly? Because way back before we started studying history, your racist founding fathers created an unfair system.
Yeah, the reason why I did laugh when you say this quote about facts are not important is that I did, in fact, encounter this in my own educational experience. I went to a theological college, a very liberal establishment. I don't want to give the impression that all theological colleges are like this. They're not. This just happened to be a very liberal one. And we were told that there are no facts. There are just interpretations. And the particular guy who was the head of the Baptist College, that's right, he was. It was an interdenominational setup there. The head of the Baptist College made this very academic by appealing to the philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant taught there are phenomena, the things that we can, as we perceive them, and the noumen of the things as they are in themselves, and he assured us all that we could only ever have access to the phenomena, the things as they appear to us, you see. And so therefore he went along this sort of radical postmodern line and ended up by saying, well, we only have interpretations, we have no access to truth, everything we think is conditioned in various ways. And then, based upon that, they then taught us what they wanted to teach, and we had to sort of fall in line. And a lot of people did fall in line.
Right, and not to be overly, I mean, that's kind of my job, but not to be overly academic as a university professor, you can make the argument that the entire modern progressive movement in all of its manifestations, and that includes socialism, communism, all of it, traces back to Kant. And of course, Kant was much broader based in his interpretation. Really, it was Hegel. It was Hegel interpreting Kant, who sort of set postmodernism on its course. This idea that everything is relative, there is no truth, and if that's true, everything then becomes merely political. And that's why for a lot of our leftist colleagues, politics are everything. There's no such thing as morality. There is no ultimate right and wrong. Justice is an illusion. Honor, duty are just made up words. You go all the way, you want to trace this all the way back. Before you could ever have Nietzsche or Marx, you had to have Kant and Hegel. That's a little more academic, I suppose, than most people want to get into. But
Hegel has come up, and Kant as well, but certainly Hegel has come up a number of times on this program.
Fantastic.
Arch statist.
Yeah, exactly. And you said it. Why are we moving ever more statist? Is because we still in this day academically, and when we teach our classes and our the way we educate our teachers, we are 100% convinced that Hegelian dialectic is the truest thing we have to describe the human condition. And so we shouldn't be surprised that statism and ultimately fascism are at the end of that long road as it
Absolutely.
Works itself out.
Yeah, and I will refer people back to an interview we had very, very early on in this podcast with Dean Gotcher, who is an expert in looking at authoritarianism and its various manifestations, but particularly in education. So I do refer people back to that. The other thing which I wanted to ask you about was, and you have touched on it already, but I think we need to say a little bit more about it, is this renaming of, well, it's not science standards, it's a renaming and throwing in this approach to science, which you say is very much based upon earth sciences. Do the students, I mean, is the idea that the students would learn everything to do with science through the earth sciences?
Well, I think it's worse than that. We're doing it to kids so young. We're introducing, I'm going to call it alarmism. I don't want you to misunderstand. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be alarmed if indeed climate is changing. What I'm saying is you're teaching to very, very young children who cannot think abstractly, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. You're teaching to little kids now before they understand what science is, before they understand what the scientific method is, before they have the ability to grasp in any way, shape, or form how we know anything in the sciences, you're scaring them to death about the death of polar bears or the fact that their grandchildren will die or the fact that in 20 years the oceans will be dead. So you're taking little kids who don't understand how science works and you are preconditioning them, A, to think that the phrase, as science says, is an absolute unqualified true. Number two, you're convincing kids. Let me step back for 1 second with you. I went to school in the 70s. I was a little kid in the 70s. And I'll never forget it. You may recall that in the 1970s, climate science was arguing that the ice age was upon us. I remember.
Absolutely. I'm probably the same generation as you because I remember it as well.
And I remember being seven years old. I was in second grade, 7 years old. And my little brain couldn't process it. I remember we spent 3 weeks in second grade talking about how mankind was ushering in a new ice age. I had nightmares for months because I imagined a 6-mile-high glacier pushing me and my family into the Pacific Ocean to drown because I could not understand anything else. And even then, Julian, what they were doing is they were preparing me. By the time I could get to understanding science, they were preparing me. They were terrifying me. The same scientists who identified the problem were the only people on Earth who could fix it. And so this is what is really troublesome about it. By the time kids get to the age where they could theoretically understand scientific modeling approaches, the difference between fact and theory, the difference between truth and hypothesis, before they're anywhere near that, they have already had this ground into them so that they have been so conditioned to be terrified of what's coming or to take as absolutely gospel
pronouncements that are still very much up in the air. That, I think, is the huge problem with this. It's the earliness and the ideology that comes with it. So in other words, by the time a kid gets to high school, I'm not bothered if that kid has had a solid education in what fact and theory and the scientific method are. I'm not bothered by introducing theorizing about global warming, provided, of course, that there is room for kids to be exposed to dissent. But that never happens in our schools. It's not happening now. And it's going to happen less than ever now that we've got things like the Common Core. Mm.
That very much connects with this whole idea of extremism, which is a big news over here with David Cameron and his Ingsoc party, which I'm turning to call it these days. You know, that anybody who thinks outside of the norm in an unorthodox way is being labeled as an extremist, which I think is a really very dangerous language.
Isn't that how statism works? Isn't that how that works? Once you centralize education control power, once you centralize the message, anybody outside that message, and your great fellow traveler, your great English colleague, George Orwell, who was himself a bit of a Fabian socialist, he made that argument. He said, in all these statist countries, there comes a time when telling the truth is the single most important thing we can do, because they're going to label you an extremist. Well, we're at the point now, right? And how about this? Explain this one to me, Julian. How is it that labeling a Islamic extreme is racist, but now we can turn around and any dissenting Christian voice is universally lauded as extreme? This is Orwellian doublespeak, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And by messing around with the language for these ideological reasons, the statist reasons, they've made it an absolute minefield. And I think they've twisted language to such an extent that it's very difficult to make sense of a lot of what's going on now. But I presume that's part of the process, because they don't really want people to understand. They want people to react and think, oh, I'm allowed to say this and I'm not allowed to say that. And that pretty much sums it up, I think.
Well, I'm sure you've been watching what's going on in American university campuses for the last few months with these protests, and you've got students now rioting and getting people fired. This is interesting. We've reached the point now, and this happened, Orwell also predicted this. We've reached the point in American universities where for generations now, we've been telling kids that their feelings matter, not thoughts, that we've been keeping them somewhat ignorant about how things really work, but making them politically outraged. And what's ironic, it's liberals on university campuses now who are being swallowed up. Liberal university professors are being driven out. Liberal faculty members who express skepticism about some of the wilder claims of the politically correct movement, they're the ones being crucified. So it's a weird system that's self-devouring, right? The very liberal progressives who propagate it, they, as Hamlet said, they may be the first swallowed, but they're last chewed. The first mouthed, but last swallowed, right? They go away too.
Yes, very worrying and dangerous times actually seem to be shaping up in many different ways. I want to come back to this business about big data. We did touch on it slightly, but I have something I want to share with you. As I say, my daughter's gone to this new school, and everything that she experienced there seems to be interwoven with data collection now. So every test that she does in the classroom, every homework that she does, every behavior assessment that she's given, so she goes to each class and she's given a mark for how well she's behaved, all of that gets logged into the school computer system. And that seems to be provided by a third-party private company. I don't know who they are, but that's the way it seems to be. And all this is supposed to improve behavior and achievement, and, you know, by providing all this diagnostic information for teachers and parents and all that, which I think it strikes me as being very Orwellian. But we are supposed to, as parents, have access to this information. It's supposed to be just for parents, just for the school. Nobody else can look at it. I have to say, I'm not convinced, and I'm certainly not convinced that will always be the case. The whole thing seems to be ill-conceived to start with and very dangerous in itself, and also seems to be encouraging students to think that they're going to spend the whole of their lives being surveyed in various ways.
Even the way they described it to you is logically inconsistent. If it is just for parents and just for the school, then the parents and the school should be the one compiling the data, but that's not what's happening. Third, independent private companies are compiling the data. Yes. The idea that this is just for you and the kids is logically, it can't be true. Those companies are storing that data. Those companies are in business to gather that data. The idea that those companies are not sharing and manipulating that data is just beyond comprehension.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think going back to our Ingsoc government that we have here with their prevent duty to do with extremism, which seems to be far broader than it needs to be and goes way beyond as a tool what I would think would be even sensible. Again, there, they are calling with this new legislation that's coming that they want private companies to hold on to people's data for a year, etc. Well, here we have an external company. Might they not say to them, we want you to keep hold of that information for X number of years so that we can, for law enforcement purposes, tap into it whenever we want? So I just feel that we have been lied to by this, and we're supposed to just trust the whole system. I do not trust it.
Well, and I've never lived in England, in the UK, so I don't know what they're doing with it, but I can tell you for a fact here that it's worse than that, that the private companies are not being asked to hold on to it. The private companies are signing it over to the federal government to hold on to. Remember, go back all the way back to the Race to the Top program, that federal program that got Common Core in the States. One of the things that you had to do when you took Race to the Top money was you had to sign a contract with the federal government whereby states were obligated to turn over various data points on the kids directly to the federal government. I'll tell you this, Julian, I do not believe for one second that these companies are holding on to the information so that the governments over there can use it later if they need to. That information is already in the possession of the government. It wouldn't make any sense. Why would you, if you're a government concerned about fighting extremism, why would you allow a private company to hold on to something until you may or may not need it? You would have it yourself.
Yes, I suppose really I was just articulating what has been said in the media. But looking at the broader picture, yes, I think it's all being kept anyway. Yes, indeed.
And is it fair to say, Julie, would you say it's fair to say in the UK that the extremists that they're targeting are far less Islamic and much more potentially Christian, right? Is that fair to say?
Well, there is a lot of concern that Christians are going to be increasingly caught up in this. And in fact, there is a Defend Free Speech organization that's set up, which is a link between the National Secularist Society and the Christian Institute. You know, you're in a most unlikely combination there. But yeah, you can just see how broad the concern is of what's going on.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, at some point, all this data is turned on the citizens, right? For one group of citizens or another, the data that they're gathering. Once the government's in charge of all of this, they get to define who the extremist is, though, don't they? We, the people, don't get to define who we think are extremists. They decide, and then all that information is already in their possession. I mean, I don't know. What is there a general outcry over there? There is here. Arguably, one of the singular most contentious aspects of Common Core is the data gathering. That's the one thing that even very liberal legislators at the state levels have balked at over Common Core. Americans have always been a little bit even conspiratorial about who's watching them and when. Is it true over there? Are you getting moms and dads concerned about the data aspects?
Do you know, I'm getting the impression that we are generally more compliant over here. I mean, I've been very exercised about this Defend Free Speech thing. And just on a personal level, I have found it incredibly difficult to engage people. I've sent out emails to people. I've, you know, engaged with social media, but, you know, to people that I know quite closely. And you don't get any response. You know, it's as if people don't want to be associated. I don't know whether it's already having an effect that people don't want to be associated because they don't want to be labeled in some way, or whether there's just that sense of, you know, we're British. You know, none of this could go wrong. That's the feeling I'm getting from people.
I think what alarms me a little bit is watching some of these moot debates at Oxford where they're starting to disinvite people because the topics are unsavory, right? Absolutely. Where they won't even allow a pro-life academic to debate a pro-choice academic because just hosting a pro-choice academic is shockingly misogynist. That doesn't bode well for anybody moving forward.
No, no. And I think there really needs to be something very much more vocal. I mean, there are things being printed, you know, even quite high-profile people in the papers being printed, etc. But, we basically need to be in the streets en masse about this, saying this is just not good enough. And I don't see moves for that. I mean, the Defend Free Speech Facebook page has been up for weeks, and I don't even think it's got 1,000 likes yet. You know, this is so important, and yet it doesn't seem to be taken as seriously as it should be.
No, and think about this. You've got American Republicans, and you've got allegedly right-of-center people like Cameron. I don't know how you measure that, but when you look at America, the Republicans aren't fighting this either. They're not the so-called Republicans aren't defending speech. And in your country, you got people like Cameron, who theoretically is right of center, who is not terribly different than the more left-wing aspects of the government. Where is, in either of our countries, that part of government who is actually responding against these encroachments upon freedom of speech, freedom of association.
Yeah, I mean, the terms of left and right are almost defunct now. And I just think of it, the way he speaks, I think you are an authoritarian.
Exactly.
That's where the phrase drops straight upon his head, you know. I mean, this is why I keep referring to him as Ingsoc. And, of course, that immediately made you think of, oh, well, of course. But, you know, it's echoing, isn't it, everywhere these days. And we can't get away from it.
Yeah, I make that argument in my talks. We don't have two parties in this country. All you have is one party that moves to the left really quickly and another party that moves a little more slowly. That's all you got in terms of infringing upon basic rights and freedoms and those things that legislatively, whether in England for centuries and centuries and centuries handed down through common law or whether in this country originating from the constitutional and founding documents, all those freedoms, liberties and rights are radically being encroached by people on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we bring the discussion back to the specifics of Common Core, which, I mean, just from what we've talked about, I could say this is essentially a statist, corporate, fascist means of controlling the populace. You know, that's what it boils down to, it seems to me. What can the people in the US, where this is obviously based, although, as you say, the plan is for the whole world, but nevertheless, in the US at the moment, what can people actually do? Because, I mean, listening to your presentation that you gave most recently, you were less optimistic, I think, than you were a year ago. You said something like, you know, it's here, and there are so many pressures within the system that it's not going to go away, or something like that.
But
we can't just stop there. There must be something.
No. After 4 years of fighting this as an activist and dealing with state legislatures, I have come to the conclusion that the system is so broken, American government school, public schools are so broken, you can't fix them from within. Luckily in America, we have a very, very vibrant, independent, and aggressive homeschool movement. Homeschool enrollments in this country in the last 10 years jumped from 2 million to 3 million families. That's a huge leap. Besides that, we have a huge private school system, Catholic schools, parochial schools, Protestant schools, non-religious private schools. These have huge numbers of students, moms and dads who pay these schools outside of the public system. So from my perspective, at least in America, we still have vibrant, useful options, a lot of classical schools, and not always about money. I mean, homeschooling is cheap and inexpensive. So as long as we have those movements burgeoning, and I like the idea of homeschooling. I mean, parents should always have been the primary stakeholders in their kids' education. They should have. America lost its way educationally when we decided about 120 years ago that it was primarily the federal government's job to educate our kids, not us. Then we lost them, and we shouldn't be surprised. And that's true over there in the UK too. If your citizens believe that government is in charge of the kids' education and should be, then we shouldn't be surprised that our kids turn out promoting government, not our values.
No, sure. That is very much the culture over here, definitely. I mean, the idea of homeschooling, it does exist, is frowned upon. There are people in my family who, well, they're actually doing it, but most of the rest of the family look upon it as something not quite right. And I can see there are dangers with it, etc., etc. But, you know, it's just something you don't do. But in the States, you say that it's a much more vibrant culture of that. So I can see how that would be much easier for people to do, because, of course, one of the things over here is if you homeschool your child, maybe you know nobody else who does, then they have a very lonely existence. But in the States, that wouldn't necessarily be the case, would it?
Oh, yeah. We've got co-ops. As a matter of fact, we've got co-ops all across the country where homeschool families get together. You know, one of the arguments against homeschooling is, well, gee, kids don't get socialized. They don't get to play high school sports, or they don't get to be on the debate team. Well, these moms and dads have taken it up so that you have co-ops where one group of homeschool kids from one town will play basketball tournaments against kids from another town. So we're recreating all of the social opportunities for kids here. Homeschooling in this country has never been more powerful. We have huge advocates for it all across the country. And of course, we now know, we have all sorts of evidence. It's not anecdotal evidence either. It's fact-based evidence that homeschool kids are getting into better colleges. Most of the major universities here have hired in the last few years people whose sole job was to go out, find, and recruit homeschool kids. So the educational performance of our homeschool kids rivals and exceeds almost in every metric what they're getting from the government schools, which means universities are targeting our kids, homeschool kids now. They have not been able to break this. One of the reasons why we allowed David Coleman to change our college entrance exams was as a way of bullying homeschoolers, right?
Uh-huh.
Think about that. The government cannot legally stop it.
So what they're doing, the next best thing, is they've turned the entrance exams for college over to somebody who's going to make it seem like, hey, if you don't, you could homeschool your kid, but if you don't teach him Common Core, he might not get into college. And that threat alone, I call it kind of educational terrorism, right? You're free to homeschool, but if you do, we're going to rig the system now so your kid falls behind.
Right. So that sort of anticipated what I was going to ask, because obviously you're saying the only way to oppose this really is outside of the system, because the system itself is just so shut up within its own processes and pressures. So therefore, the only thing that the state can do is attack anything that's outside of the parameters of this system. And you say this is going on, but it's not working. But do you see any further strategies as to how the state might actually try to move its empire to take everything under its wing?
Sure. And that has to be the goal, right? I mean, they are not trying to get 60 million kids on the same program to then allow 5 million kids to opt out of that. That is not practical. No. So what they're doing now is they're using subtle pressure. We mentioned David Coleman and empowering him without any credentials to sort of blackmail homeschool students with this new change. The other thing that they're going to start, what they are doing now, is they're trying to use their federal leverage to pressure states into not allowing moms and dads to opt out of the exams. That's the big thing now. Every state allows parents to opt out, even in the public schools, to opt out of these big meaningless exams. Of course, Common Core doesn't work without the purpose of Common Core is the exams. That's where the data comes from. And so moms and dads by the millions are opting kids out of these tests. And the federal government now is trying to bribe and coerce the states to, at the state level, prohibit their citizens from opting out. Some states are considering it, others not. So as long as the states hold firm and allow their parents to opt out, the feds are, or for lack of a better word, the feds are kind of screwed. But the feds now are using a lot of political pressure and a lot of money. They're telling states, okay, we're not going to give you federal education dollars if you keep allowing your parents to opt out of our exams. So that's the next thing coming. Sooner or later, someone will throw enough money at enough states to get venal state politicians to ban parents from opting out. That's when you're in real trouble. Hasn't happened yet, but that's the next front in this war.
And so why would that be a problem? Couldn't it just be that the parents would say, okay, I'll let my child do this exam? Is there some sort of financial penalty or something here?
Not yet, no. I mean, and that's why parents are opting out, because the whole thing is based on the exams. But that's coming. And some states are even floating legislation. Well, maybe we'll allow our families to homeschool, but require them every couple years to take our Common Core tests, right? They know they legally can't undermine what parents do educationally with their kids. But what they can do is create the, and we've seen this before, right? Create such a Byzantine regulatory state for how you do homeschool that more and more parents will just drop out of frustration. That's how they're attacked. So they're not powerful yet enough to just simply outright stop it. So what they're going to do is throw so many spanners in the works. I think that's a Britishism, isn't it? They're going to throw.
It is indeed.
They're going to throw so many spanners in the work that a lot of moms and dads who otherwise would do it will get frustrated. And if they can winnow it down, that's the program now in the short term.
Okay, and so the ostensible reason then would be this is for quality purposes, presumably. They want to make sure that the homeschooling is up to standard, et cetera.
Yes.
And so they throw in so many benchmarks that you have to reach.
Well, and think about that. So they've decided that we want to make sure that homeschool kids are doing well in our non-homeschool curriculum, right? Do you see the statist implication there? Well, we're going to let you educate your kid at home, provided that doesn't deviate too much from the way we're making them be educated in public schools. You see a certain already Orwellian cross purposes in the way that's set up.
Yeah. So people who are taking this route in order to resist this system need to remain absolutely vigilant to what's coming down the road with this.
And there is some good news, Julian, because in the last year, a number of American universities have come flat out and said, we will no longer consider ACTs and SATs. We realize that it's all just BS. We're not going to even look at those stupid entrance exams anymore because there's so much more that goes into an educated kid. And that's frustrating them. So in other words, the universities, radical liberal universities are beginning to decide, you know what? These big stupid exams aren't telling us anything. So we're maybe not going to look at them. And that's also a huge challenge now that's being posed to the federal takeover, because without the universal exam bait to sort of keep kids in line, there's really no reason to take the test.
So people do really need to be encouraged to go down this route very, very much. And your organization is really central to encouraging everybody to think about pursuing education in this way. Could you lead people to your website so that people can find you easily?
Yes, please. Go take a look at Freedom Project, Freedom Project Education. Our website is fpeusa.org. There you will find all sorts of free Common Core resources. We don't ask you for anything. All links and data, slide, all the presentations we've given. We're even going to throw this interview, if you send us the podcast, send it to us. We'll throw it up on our site too. So American people, if they stumble across it, can listen, hopefully listen to you, Julian, in the interview here. We're a homeschool aid. We try to help moms and dads who want to homeschool their kids, but don't feel like they can do it all. Oh, look, I know how to teach my kid how to read. I know how to teach him history. But how in the world am I, a mom, going to teach my kid chemistry? So we can provide a chemistry class for them with a real teacher online. We want educational control to be in the hands of moms and dads. Now, if you're a mom and dad who wants to send your kid to the public schools, go for it. But if you're a mom and dad who recognizes the dangers of that and wants the freedom to oversee and orchestrate their kid's own education, then we want to make that. We want to keep that viable. We both know that as long as people are availing themselves of non-government options, those options will remain strong. And it's only when people stop patronizing them that they dry up and go away. So we want to make sure that American families have an option that is outside of this rather fractured and broken system.
Yeah, and it does require people really to kind of think outside the box and think, well, it's worth taking the risk here because there's a lot to be gained and there's a lot to be lost by just allowing things to go on without really using your critical faculties and questioning what the state is actually trying to do. So I do very much applaud what you're doing. I think it's fascinating. I think it's kind of risky. It's kind of on the edge, but I do think it's a fantastic thing to be doing.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, one of those infinitely racist and bigoted founding fathers of ours once observed that patriotism requires vigilance, right? That you have to be vigilant and responsible for the things you can, or else someone's going to take away the things you're responsible for. And I think that's what this is all about. I'd love to see a movement like this over in the UK. I know there's a very strong silent majority over there who would understand the necessity of having options that are not government. And I just don't know how we reach them.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we do. And this little podcast here, perhaps is going to have some part of it, some tiny little corner of what's going on over here. At least I hope so. You also have a show called now Right Makes Might with Dr. Duke. How's that going?
It's going great. We've done about 6 episodes and it's getting shared all over the place. It's a kind of a half hour, like up to a half hour. We do little segments of commentary. Basically, it's me taking issues ripped from the headlines and doing some. Think about what Jon Stewart does for the left. Or John Oliver now, another one of your wonderful, you keep giving us people like John Oliver and Piers Morgan. And with all due respect, you got to take Piers back, okay? But sort of like that, but with sense of humor, a little bit of sarcasm, but coming at it from a perspective on the right, not the left, and using the tools of humor and satire and hopefully a sound judgment to poke a little fun at some of the excesses of the people on the left.
Well, you're certainly a born showman on that show. So great. Yeah, so very much enjoyed speaking to you, as I did last time, actually. And I think this interview complements very much what you said last time. And I do, as I said earlier on, please do go back, listen to the original interview here at TMR with Dr. Duke, because there was so much more information in that. And the two together, I think, do give a very good view of what's happening today and where this whole business of Common Core has come from and how it's developed. So thank you ever so much, Dr. Pester, for coming on again. It's been great to speak to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Rule Britannia and all that. I hope you guys are vibrant. We need you in the world. We need that great British wryness when it comes to the nonsense that's happening. So let's get everybody back on the same page and stand up for Western values.
Fantastic. Rule Britannia. Britannia waves the rules.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thank you. And you.
Follow the money, scales will fall from your eyes. Education, education, just a cult in disguise. After 10 years in the system, they can read and they can write, but they know the carbon footprint and they know the human right. Tell them that they're all evolving and a brand new world awaits. That they gotta tell their mama when they meet her at the gates. Yes, you better watch out what they're teaching your children. Outcome based
outcome-based education from the World Cup curriculum. You better watch out what they're teaching your children. Gonna take it, gonna break it, gonna make it for the highs. Watch out what they're teaching your children.